You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, June 2nd, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Guten Abend, mein Freund.
And we have two special guest rogues this week, Fraser Cain.
Hey, guys.
And Pamela Gay.
Hey, everyone.
Yo.
Pamela and Fraser, of course, are famous for Astronomy Cast. They're a world-famous science podcast. They've been on the show before. In fact, I think you guys were the first guests that we really had on as, like, full guest rogues, not just an interview. So you were the trailblazers. You were good enough to come back on the show at short notice because we were planning on having you guys on, but Rebecca couldn't make it tonight, and it just works better if we're going to be short anyway to do the guest rogues on those weeks. So with very short notice, you guys were willing to come on. So thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
Even two of us can't fill her shoes.
That's right. So, Fraser, we were trying to come up with some topics to talk about tonight, and you were telling us about the X-37, which is pretty exciting. Can you let us know about that?
So, the X-37, you might have heard, this is an Air Force space plane. This has been in the works. You know, we've had stories on Universe Today about it over the last 10 years or so, but it gotten closer and closer to launch. It was originally supposed to be launched on Columbia, but there was an accident with Columbia, as you all recall, and so they moved it to a Delta rocket. And on April 22nd,
yep,
it launched and is happily in orbit.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it kind of came out of nowhere, where, you know, everyone was sort of expecting what's happening with the space shuttle and what are the Chinese doing? And then suddenly, oh, by the way, here's this Air Force space plane launched and orbiting. And one of the really cool things about it is there's some really neat photographs and videos that people have been taking from the ground,
mm-hmm.
getting some looks at it. So if anyone tells you that, you know, we're not actually going to space, you can show them some of these pictures.
And what's really cool is this was supposed to be a top secret mission that no one was supposed to know about. But pioneering amateur astronomers, starting with Greg Roberts down in Cape Town, South Africa, they started timing it and tracking it and calculating the orbit. And now you can look it up in heavens above and go take a look for yourself.
So what's the difference between a space plane and just like a space shuttle or a spaceship? Why is it a space plane?
Well, technically, the space shuttle is a space plane as well. The basic idea is a space plane is something that lands on wheels, whereas a space capsule, something like what they have the Soviets land in, those come down on parachutes and splash down in water, land hard on land with a thud rather than a wheels down moment. So this is just one of a new line of spacecraft for the United States.
What would you call a spaceship that lands like the typical UFO, like straight down with like 3 feet? What do you call that?
Non-real.
Yeah, non-real.
And so, so the difference with this and the space shuttle, right, is the space shuttle has the gigantic external fuel tank. It has the solid rocket boosters, and it's a real custom machine.
Yeah.
With the X-37, or at least with the prototype, it was bolted to the top of a Delta II rocket, which is a fairly standard launch vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a nice in between a capsule in that it can, you know, be carried on top of a rocket up into space, but then it can land like an airplane, which gives it, you know, it's like, was it like flying a brick?
It's
right, flying a space shuttle, right?
And there's one of these?
Well, there's one orbiting.
Yeah, it's just a prototype.
It's a prototype, yeah.
But it's orbiting. And that's the cool part.
That is cool.
That is really cool.
Details about crew and cargo? I mean, how many people can it take up there? And is this going to be adequate for us to resupply the International Space Station?
Was it ever designed to hold people, though? I thought it was more of just an unmanned vehicle.
Oh, no, it's small.
Yeah.
It's tiny.
It's being compared more to the unmanned airplanes that we use over in Afghanistan.
Oh.
But the thing is, this is the type of thing that can be scaled up easily. And while it's currently unmanned, there's drawings of, well, here's what you need to do to add a person. It's not going to be person controlled. This is going to be the type of thing that the early astronauts fought tooth and nail against. This is going to be a craft that flies itself. But it's not a huge step to take these plans and add to them the same way we took our early unmanned rockets and just added a capsule to them. It's designed for that type of expansion.
And then if we do scale it up, do we have rockets big enough to put the bigger versions of it into orbit?
Well, this is the problem, right, with the cancellation of big parts of the Constellation program.
Yeah, that's right? What I'm getting at, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, right. So the big rocket was going to be the Ares 5, and that was going to be able to launch, you know, houses and all kinds of things into space. But without that, the heavy, heavy launch capability of the United States goes away with the space shuttle. And there's no alternative planned right now.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have to use a space elevator.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
But while this isn't top something floor that we can do heavy lift with, it's possible that with its current Delta rocket, you might be able to get a couple people or a little bit of cargo up. It's never going to be heavy lift. But it could offer our low Earth orbit replacement, at least until we get something better.
It could be a stopgap.
Yeah,
I mean, it's kind of a really funny time for all of this because we
I'm not
had
laughing.
Yeah, not at all. Well, kind of. Really? Funny, bizarre. Funny, peculiar. Because we had the Constellation program being canceled, and that was like the big plan. But now there's all these other flowers blooming. There's all these other ideas that are coming forth. All of the, you know, there's the Falcon 9 that's being tested,
yeah,
which is a, you know, a private rocket. There's stuff happening with the Chinese. There's stuff happening with the Russians. So I think that we're still in the chaos of the Constellation program being canceled. But I think over the next year, couple of years, there's going to be a lot more really interesting projects that are going to come out. And I think people are going to feel a lot better soon.
What's your opinion? Do you think net positive or negative canceling the Constellation program?
Depends on Pamela.
So one of the things I've really respected is I've heard a whole series of NASA HQ people, one after another, saying, we are in the process of convening panels of experts from academia, from industry, from within NASA itself to sit down, hash out realistic timelines, hash out realistic budgets, hash out a solid set of core goals. And once we have that in hand, then we're going to tell you what our timelines are. Then we're going to tell you what our goals are. Constellation was behind budget. It was over budget. It was behind deadline. They were still finding things that they hadn't remembered that they needed to budget and plan for. It was a project that didn't have enough R&D go into it before they started piecing pieces together. I think what they're doing right now, sweeping everything off the desk and picking things they need up off the floor and throwing everything else out, we all need to do that occasionally. And NASA's doing that right now. And I kind of respect that. I'll respect it more when I see what the results are, though.
Yeah, I think someone from NASA said that if you delivered all of the hardware to us with all, you know, research completed, all worked, was all sitting right there ready to go, we still wouldn't be able to cover the maintenance costs and operation costs of this with the budget that we had. So they didn't have the budget to do the research. So I think it was kind of a fantasy. And so you kind of say, well, is it better to not have the fantasy and just have the cold reality? And in this situation, I like that a lot better.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, the worst case scenario would be to continue it when it was a guaranteed failure because it was underfunded. So they had
right.
to do one thing or the other.
Yeah.
Either increase the funding or back off totally.
How about with projects of this magnitude just, you know, not screwing it up, you know? Like you said, you know, they should have put the R&D
in. Yeah, I think they considered that and, you know, took it off the table.
Well, there's this strange dichotomy of the one thing that I can look at back in the Bush presidency that was kind of cool was the Let's Get Back to the Moon initiative that was put forward. And saying let's go to the moon from a president, though, that's awesome, but Congress has to give NASA the funding, and Congress has not given the necessary funding to fulfill that dream.
And I mean, the goal of going to the moon, going to asteroids, going to Mars is, you know, the most important thing to me anyway. I think that's – I wish we could do that. But I also feel like when there is a, you know, sort of a singular vision coming from the government – it tends to kind of swamp out other people's ideas. It's like people go, oh, okay, the government's got that covered. We're going to go to the moon. So, you know, let's not work on it. And I think that when you get the situation where where there is a lack of leadership and there's a lack of commitment from above, then it really builds that community and the solidarity of the pro space, the alt space people who are good at pulling things, you know, pulling up by their bootstraps. And so the Falcon 9 is a great example of that, right? You've got a, you know, committed entrepreneur who's built a rocket and it works and it's going to provide a private alternative. So I don't know. I feel like when we don't have that big vision and leadership coming from the top, then that's when you get the thousand flowers blooming. And I find that a lot more exciting. It's a lot more dynamic and interesting. And that way, the big delays, the big cancellations, the changes in government, none of that has an effect on it. Everything's moving forward.
And we have hope in the form of the Google Lunar X Prize, a prize to give $30 million to the first competitor that lands a robot on the moon. The more we can get the commercial space agencies, commercial space companies out there building our dreams for us and making it commercially viable, the closer we are to having our own little personal rocket ships. Yeah. I'm hoping that in our lifetime we'll get to see a battle similar to what Pan Am and TWA went through, but this time it'll be Virgin Galactic and Bigelow or some other pair of arguing commercial companies.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that the private commercial, you know, profitable model is probably the way to go in the long term. I guess the question is, have we bridged that gap? Have we gotten to the point with, you know, government-funded space exploration that it's viable? Because otherwise, if the activation resources are too high, if it costs billions to get going, then that's where there are barriers to a for-profit model.
Yeah, I mean, my personal feeling on this is that government's role is to solve the technical challenges, to make sure that there's funding there to research the things that no private company could do. How can we, can we get fuel costs down? How can we raise lifting, raise up? How can we find materials that can make a space elevator? And be able to fund that kind of research, but then not necessarily hold on to it too hard at the end.
Yeah, but then basically lower those barriers for the private industry to do it themselves.
Yeah.
One more thing, Steve. Jay, you want your science fiction rocket, vertical takeoff and landing? Do you guys remember the Delta Clipper DCX in the 90s? They actually had one single stage to orbit. It was really cool. You know, it lands like the old science fiction rockets. But it obviously never went anywhere, but we did have a working prototype, Jay, so that might make you a little happy.
Well, I never heard of it. I never saw any pictures or video.
Google
never
it, dude. Delta Clipper.
Delta Clipper. Okay.
Evan, before we go on to other news items, what's the skeptical day today?
Oh, yes, of course. Okay, so this podcast is airing on June 5th, 2010. And it was June 5th, 1977. When the very first personal computer, the Apple II, went on sale.
What happened to the Apple I?
The Apple I was a designation for an earlier computer that was it was just really a board, and you had to supply your own keyboard, monitor, and case for it. So it wasn't really, I suppose, technically a personal computer.
You had to supply your own squirrel for the wheel.
Yeah. Hey, what about the Altair? Wasn't that the first PC?
There were a couple other PCs that came out later that year, the TRS-80 and the Commodore PET, but Apple II beat them to it. Now, this Apple II had the ability to do high-res and low-res color graphics. It had sound, a joystick input, cassette tape in and out, 8 expansion slots for peripherals, the clock speed, 1 megahertz, and the memory in it was 64K.
For 64K, I remember that. I had one of those things.
Wow.
And then when the 2E came out and it was like 128K, that was exciting.
Whoa.
my dog has something on his collar that's more powerful than those.
Yeah, I had a Commodore 64. That was my first machine.
I admit I learned to count so I could find Pong on the audio cassette attached to our Apple.
Right. Remember the first hard drive I bought was 10 megabytes. And it was huge.
All right, let's stop dating ourselves, shall we?
Yeah. Okay. So enough of that. Enough of history.
It is funny how you can date yourself now to the year based upon your computer purchases.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Bob, this is an item from a couple of weeks ago, but you're going to tell us a little bit about a breakthrough in synthetic bacteria.
Yeah, not a little bit. But we've all heard about it now, right, guys? Craig Venter's synthetic cell. Is it all in the news around a couple of weeks ago? Craig Venter might sound familiar, that name. He's a biologist and entrepreneur. He announced that he and his team had created the first synthetic cell, ushering in, as he says, a new phase of biology, designing and synthesizing life. But what his team did, they took a bacterial cell, this was M. capricolum, and they hoovered out the DNA inside the cell and kind of just put the cell aside. And then they went to work using a sequencing machine that held this full digital sequence of another bacteria. It was similar, but it was a different species of bacteria called M. myocoides. And what they did was they used ordinary chemicals and the sequencing machine. They created these snippets of DNA. Now, for some reason, I couldn't find out why. Steve, maybe you know, but these sequencers cannot create an arbitrarily long length of DNA. They can only create like a maximum of like 1,000 base pairs long. And for some reason, it kind of has to stop there. So what they ended up with is 1,000 pieces of DNA, each one 1,000 base pairs long. So one of the big problems was, how do we put all this together into a unified genome? So what they did is they took those tiny snippets and they put them in E. coli, and E. coli made bigger ones. And then they took those bigger pieces and they finally put them in yeast cells, and the yeast was able to put all these big pieces into a single whole bacterial genome. So they put it all together, which was a first. No one's really ever done that before, I don't think. So now you have this synthetic bare genome, which was identical, right, to the regular, this myocoides bacteria, except there was a few differences, though. They put watermarks. They actually put watermarks in the genome. They encoded things like the scientists that worked on the project, and quotes from literature. Like, my favorite quote that they put in there was from the biography of Oppenheimer. He said, "See things not as they are, but as they might be." Some other differences: they removed 10 potentially pathogenic genes. That was nice of them. There was also replication errors. Steve, are you aware of this? There was actually unavoidable replication errors within the genome that they identified afterwards, but they were harmless, so they really had no real impact, but they were there. They also, if you ever see a picture of these cells, they were blue. They looked kind of odd. They had like this blue center to them, but that's actually from a gene that they inserted. It was a LACZ gene that they put in there that actually turns the cell blue, so that you know that things were working in there. And the one other notable difference, though, with this genome was that it was made by a computer and not a mommy bacteria. So that was pretty significant, even though it was essentially the same genome. So the final step then, of course, would be to take this genome that they created and put it inside that bacterial cell that had no DNA in it. So now what you have is a cell with cytoplasm, which was from one species of bacteria, but you also have with that inside is a slightly altered synthetic DNA copy of another bacteria species floating around inside of that. So then the scientists attach electrodes to the cell, and they raise it up into the sky during an electrical storm. Oh wait, no, they didn't do that. But it wasn't that dramatic. But basically, the cellular machinery in the cytoplasm just read the foreign DNA and started making proteins and metabolizing and reproducing as instructed by the DNA. So the cell was, you know, booted up, as they say. So how important was this? You know, is this synthetic life or not? And a lot of people have opinions about it. Caltech geneticist David Baltimore says that Venter had not created life, he only mimicked it. And geneticist George Church said that printing out a copy of an ancient text isn't the same as understanding the language. Now, this is all true, but there's a bit of a semantic game going on, I think.
It's irrelevant. It's totally irrelevant.
It is.
The point of this was not the end product. It was the process.
Right.
So, yeah, you end up with a bacteria that's no different than just doing a little bit of genetic engineering to a pre-existing bacterium. But the whole point was a proof of concept that this method works. Now they can start tinkering.
Right. Yeah, and that's what a lot of people are missing. But it's interesting, though, because I was disappointed when I actually read this. I couldn't believe the first few news articles I read were very kind of general, and they were a little bit vague. And I just assumed that they had created a genome from scratch, a minimum genome that I had been reading about for years, that they had actually used that. But then when I got into the nitty-gritty of what they actually did, I found out that they actually copied this other bacteria. And I was, for a little while there, I was like, oh, damn, it's, you know, because my expectations were so high. But now that I've thought about it, it is quite a significant act. And Steve, you said in your blog that that this was an incremental step. And you're right, it is. But it's an incremental step for a scientist, ultimately a giant leap for, well, if you know what I'm, you know what I mean. But it actually was pretty significant.
Oh, yeah.
Fully synthetic or not, incremental or not, this is ultimately, like you said, a proof of concept that life can be designed and synthesized.
Well, this is a tremendous research tool, if nothing else, because, as you say, they could basically make any change they want to the genome and then see what happens. So it's a really great way to test hypotheses about how the genome translates into the final organism and what role it's playing.
I remember during his presentation, Ventnor was saying that they got stymied for several months by a programming error. They had somehow introduced a bug, you know, a coding error into one of their snippets, and had spent a long time trying to debug and figure out where they had made their mistake. So it's funny to hear it become a lot more like computer programming.
Fraser, I think you might be talking about one thing I read about concerning this. There was one base pair error.
That's right.
It was one error, one base pair, and it essentially shut down the entire genome. Imagine how critical that must have been, because you know you've got huge swaths of a genome out there that with junk DNA that you could just go crazy with and nothing's going to happen. But they had an error with that one base pair that just kind of like, off switch, sorry, I'm not going to do anything.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't the sort of the fundamental concept didn't work. It's that they had just made one little programming error with the bacteria. And once they fixed that, then the process was able to move forward.
Right.
And Bob, you bring up junk DNA, and this, it would be a great way to test that hypothesis, wouldn't it be? If you can remove large chunks of the genome without any effect on the final product, that would be an important proof of concept, too.
Yeah, that's where the soul is.
Right.
Right? So you remove all that, and that bacteria has no soul.
The soulless bacteria.
Yeah.
Why would you say that?
That's hurtful.
All right. Well, the next news item is a little bit of an old news item, but it's not one that we have covered. And it's the question about Phobos, one of the two moons of Mars. To what degree is Phobos hollow versus solid?
1/3.
30% plus or minus 5%.
See, that was a good guess on my part.
30% hollow.
Right. And this is a really neat piece of work, because the orbit of Phobos has always been a little bit off, and there's an interesting theory put forward that at one point that it was hollow and maybe synthetic, but the Viking missions easily put that aside. It's clearly a natural looking object. But it's an object that formed after Mars and was captured, and it appears to be not so much one nice solid potato, but rather a whole bunch of small rocky bits, some large, some small, all gravitationally bound together with gaps, with chasms inside. And those chasms all add up to 30% hollow.
Yeah, so it's more like a rubble pile than one solid object. Yeah, and it's not so much hollow as it's just the different pieces don't fit snugly together, so there were gaps where they don't fit together.
And there's not enough gravity to make it snug.
Exactly.
Right. Just not being crushed into a sphere.
That's a second generation moon, correct, when a moon develops?
Yes, it's a second generation. It coalesced in orbit or was captured in orbit after Mars formed. And what's amazing, though, is just how they did this.
Yeah,
they very carefully flew Mars Express past it, turned off all the cameras, and directed all of their energy into sending a radio beam back to Earth and looking for shifts in that radio signal that would allow them to measure deviations in Mars Express orbit due to the gravity of Phobos. And it was that gravitational tug from just between 60 and 70 kilometers away that led us to realize, this is something that is not as dense as you might think. We knew how big it was. Once we knew what sort of gravitational pull it let loose, we could measure just how dense it was, or in this case, how porous it was.
Guys, was this the moon that weirdo guy said was actually an alien spacecraft that we covered
about
a year ago? Remember that he had
Richard Hoagland?
You mean Hoagland?
He's good.
Was it Hoagland that said that? He had all those geometric
He says a lot of stuff. So
Hoagland.
He says he worked for NASA.
Yeah, he's got
other things.
He's got one of those like 30-foot tall websites if you were like right. to print it out.
Well, one of the great things about Phobos is it's doomed. Phobos has only got between like 1 in 10 million years to live because it's it orbits too closely to Mars and is on a spiral inward, the opposite of what our moon, the moon, is doing. So within a couple of million years, Phobos is going to tear up and form a little ring around Mars and then crash into the surface and form these big long chains of craters.
Is that because it's within the Roche limit? Is that what it is?
It's because it's tell me if I'm wrong, panel. It's because it orbits faster than Mars rotates. So the tidal forces between them are pulling Phobos down and slowing the Earth orbit. Is that right? And then the moon
– the Mars orbit.
So the Mars orbit. Sorry. And then in our situation, because the moon orbits longer than an Earth day, it's spiraling outward and slowing down our day.
And in both cases, the real kicker is we're not dealing with perfect spheres. The Earth's moon, it looks fairly spherical, not quite its center of mass is off the center geometrically. But with Mars, we're actually dealing with this really asymmetric little world. It's a southern hemisphere and northern hemisphere have radically different average altitudes. It has Olympus Mons standing out on one side and this giant chasm. Yeah. It's not a sphere. And then Phobos is just plain old a potato.
Yeah.
So there's lots and lots of tidal torques going on. And in this case, it's just like Fraser said, the orbital period carries it around faster than the day, and it's slowly spiraling in at 1 to 2 centimeters a year.
So could we actually alter these orbits with a spaceship or a rocket of some kind?
If we wanted to.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Expensive.
Yeah.
So if you want to save Phobos, you've got to raise it up to the point that it takes longer to go around Mars than a day on Mars.
We need to start a campaign, Save Phobos.
Phobos, yeah.
We'll start by canceling the Constellation program.
Here's my thought with Phobos. So if there are huge chasms inside the thing, wouldn't that be a great place to build the space station? Because you have sort of built-in protection from the cosmic rays with the rock all that would be all around you.
Well, there have been some mission ideas, right, that Phobos is a much better target for exploration of Mars. Go to Phobos first.
Yeah.
And, explore that and put a space station there, then try to actually land down on the surface of Mars. But that's just
this
not
is what
as
I'm
cool.
saying. This is what we should be doing right now. and instead, we're canceling programs and, what the hell?
Well,
come on, you two guys, get pissed off. Let me hear you get mad about this.
The thing is, I really want to see commercial space get out there and start doing this because I want to go and I don't want to have to run a mile fast enough to be an astronaut. And you're right, Phobos is an amazing target. And I could be mixing my moons, but I'm pretty sure in Kim Stanley Robinson's Red Mars series, he actually has Phobos lifted up into a geosynchronous orbit and they attach a space elevator to it, making it extremely easy to get back and forth. And I'm just, that's a really awesome concept. And yes, it does make a perfect target for manned spaceflight and potentially for digging down deep and building ourselves a nice radiation safe home.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go on to the next news item. So this is actually quite a bit of interesting science. This has to do with the mechanisms for pain relief, although there's a couple of wrinkles we'll get to later in just a minute. So what's interesting about this, in my opinion, is that there's only so many different ways that we can decrease pain, right? There are categories of medications that basically target different receptors or mechanisms. So we have sodium channel blockers and opiate agonists and prostaglandin inhibitors and things like that. But there's a very finite number. So whenever we discover a a new potential target, that opens up the possibility for a whole new category of interventions, pharmacological and otherwise. So that's what this research ultimately has to do. What the researchers found is an article published in Nature Neuroscience. The lead author was Nana Goldman. They looked at a mouse model of pain and identified the fact that after mechanical production of pain, that adenosine is released in large amounts locally, and that peaks at about 30 minutes, and that correlates with decreased pain perception in the mice. They then did they did a chain of experiments, which really demonstrates nicely, you know, how researchers will probe all around a question until they lock everything together. So they said, okay, so we have an increase in adenosine. Maybe it's binding to the adenosine A1 receptor. So let's give a drug that will block that receptor and see if that blocks the pain response, and it did. And let's give another drug that's an adenosine A1 receptor agonist that activates it and see if that replicates the pain relief. And it does. And then they did it in a knockout mouse that lacks the gene for the adenosine A1 receptor, and they did not have the analgesic effect. So you basically probe it in every different way, and they pretty convincingly demonstrated that in response to mechanical pain, there is an increase in adenosine, it binds to the A1 adenosine receptor, and that decreases both pain and probably also inflammation as well. And it seems to be a very temporary local response to mechanical pain. Now, it would be nice if we could move on to the next news item and that were the whole story. But the real story that's going on here is this was all done in the context of acupuncture, meaning that the mechanical stimulation that was given in order to produce pain was sticking a human-sized acupuncture needle in near the knee of these mice into some alleged acupuncture point. And what that led to was this news item, which when you really look at what's going on in the research, being it's not about acupuncture, but being spun as science discovers that acupuncture works for pain relief and how it works for pain relief, when in fact it showed neither of those two things. Sounds a little counterintuitive at first, but you know, bear with me for a second. Plus, you know, you can also read about this pretty much. You know, all of these skeptical physicians blogged about this. So I blogged about it on Science Based Medicine and Neurologica. David Gorski blogged about it on Science Based Medicine, and that is his alter ego as well. And David Cahoon blogged about it, and Not Exactly Rocket Science blogged about it. We all pretty much had the same take on it, which was that the researchers actually didn't study acupuncture. Now, they defined acupuncture in the beginning of their article as sticking needles in specific points and manipulating them for pain relief. However, they didn't test whether or not sticking the needle in one location, an alleged acupuncture point, versus another location had any difference in the response. So if acupuncture is sticking needles into specific points, they didn't test the specific points aspect of that, and they also didn't test the sticking needles part of it. Now, other research looking at local tissue responses or biochemical responses to pain will do things like do vibration as a stimulus or just pinching as a stimulus versus needle insertion, and they generally find that the results are the same, that you have a certain threshold of local trauma or pain production, and that will trigger whatever the response is to that. These researchers did not do that. So they didn't actually explore the two variables that they defined as equaling acupuncture, sticking needles and doing it in acupuncture points. What they really found, in my opinion, is they found a potential mechanism for the non-specific effects, local tissue effects, that are often misinterpreted as specific acupuncture effects. So what skeptics have been saying for years about acupuncture is that the ritual of acupuncture, and of course the chi and the meridians and the energy, has nothing to do with what's going on, that in fact there are just non-specific responses, including placebo responses, but also potentially some local tissue responses, either counter irritation you know, which I always describe as like if you bang your elbow, you rub it, and that makes it temporarily feel better, right? Or relaxation and things like that that can produce nonspecific decreases in the perception of pain and maybe even the local transmission of pain. And they, what they found is 100% consistent with that interpretation of the literature that this is that any perceived decrease in pain due to acupuncture is not due to any of the anything that's specific to acupuncture. It's a non-specific response to just, you know, the ritual of acupuncture. However, the authors of this study, this is the real incredible thing about this, is the absolute garbage that the authors of this study were able to say in a peer-reviewed journal, and a very high-impact one too, the Nature Neuroscience. What I suspect is, I don't know who the reviewers were, but I suspect that they gave this article to reviewers who were acupuncturists. Or who, you know, were doing similar kinds of research so that they were, yeah, they were on the same page, you know, with the acupuncture proponents who did the study. So the opening paragraph is just a bunch of apologetics for acupuncture, and it's all factually incorrect. They say that acupuncture has been used for 4,000 years when, in fact, what they're researching is not what was being done thousands of years ago. So it's not the modality is probably actually much, much more recent than that. They also went out of their way to like make this argument from popularity, how it's used, you know, around the world, and you know, sort of dissing Western skeptics, saying they're inhibiting research. And they even, this is the funniest line they said, perhaps most tellingly, the U.S. Internal Revenue Service approved acupuncture as a deductible medical expense in 1973. Right. The IRS is now an authority on medical science, according to these authors.
Wow.
Yeah, just ridiculous. And now the press release was as promotional and misleading as the authors were in the study. And the mainstream media, the mainstream press, 100% of it that I have seen, I looked around quite a bit, bought the press release hook, line, and sinker. Even usually responsible and high-quality outlets. Even Scientific American, their 60-second podcast, got it totally wrong. Ironically, this could lead to developing pharmaceuticals and other interventions that could exploit that. You know, the thing is that this doesn't really translate well to human applications because mice are a lot smaller than people. And, you know, so imagine sticking a huge needle into a tiny little mouse knee. Their muscles are smaller, the distance between the nerve and the muscle is smaller, and also the what we call the motor end plates, those locations where the nerves innervate the muscles, are going to be much closer together.
The chi lines are smaller.
The chi meridians are smaller. So you can pretty much jab them anywhere, and you're probably going to be hitting a motor end plate. And there is evidence that, you know, by doing that, you know, the motor end plate, that's what probably provokes a lot of the local responses. That doesn't mean that the same thing will happen in a human when you scale up to human size. And also, even if you can provoke an effect in a human, which they didn't demonstrate, they did just mice, it's a very temporary effect. So it's essentially you're causing acute pain in order to provoke a response to that pain that, you know, 30 minutes or so later is meant to inhibit the local pain and inflammation, which can then mask or treat a chronic pain for a very short period of time. It's actually not that clinically useful. And in fact, the clinical data on acupuncture is pretty much negative. I mean, this is a really well-studied modality. And in fact, while the authors of this study incorrectly said that there's this, you know, growing evidence that acupuncture works for analgesia, in fact, the evidence shows it doesn't work. I think they completely misrepresented the research when they were trying to promote acupuncture in their article.
But Steve, is that like punching someone in the arm?
Yeah.
And then noting 30 minutes later that the pain in their arm starts to go away, and
right,
noting that punching a person in the arm causes pain to go away?
Well, so it makes sense that if you provoke pain, you like local trauma results in pain and inflammation, and then a secondary, you know, effect 30 minutes or so later that then is there to inhibit that pain and inflammation. That makes total physiological sense that would happen. And you know, if you had, let's say, a pain in your neck and I punch you in the shoulder, and then, you know, after a while that pain goes away, maybe your neck won't hurt, you know, for a half an hour or so while the adenosine is surging, you know, locally. But is that really a good way to treat your neck pain? But if we could make a pharmaceutical agent that can bind to the A1 receptor for a long period of time without, you know, using trauma to provoke it, then that may actually be a new analgesic target. And so this may actually result in some interesting follow-up research and applications. Just has nothing to do with acupuncture. That's a complete, you know, misdirection, if you will. And it's really just mischief caused by the fact that, in my opinion, what the real core fallacy here is that the definition of acupuncture is vague and varies, you know, from use to use. So it could mean manipulating chi or just any sticking of needle anywhere in the body to provoke any kind of response, you know, using electricity at the same time, or, you know, all those things go under this very broad umbrella of acupuncture. So you could research one aspect of sticking needles in the skin, call that acupuncture, and that ultimately gets translated to the public as acupuncture works. Meanwhile, people are sticking needles, you know, to manipulate chi to cure cancer, and they're calling that acupuncture too. So that's what causes all the mischief, you know, and it's just sloppy science. You know, science requires strict operational definitions. You know, if we're going to call something acupuncture, we have to know what it actually means. So, Jay, did you see that picture of the ginormous sinkhole in Guatemala?
Yeah, not only did I see it, but I had an argument with a friend at work claiming to him that it had to be a fake.
You thought it was a fake?
I absolutely thought it was a fake. I'm looking at a picture of it right now, and it still looks like a fake.
Jay, I agree. When I first saw that, I thought Photoshop. It looked like a big laser beam from a bored cube just bored out a hole in the city. It's like, that can't be right. It was just too even. The sides of the hole was just too identical. It just didn't seem right to me until
it looks like a cartoony clip art of a hole.
It does. It actually, let me tell you like what happened in my head in the conversation that I had. So I had discussion/arguments with a couple of different people, but because I'm always the person at work and, you know, the one that says, no, and this is BS, and, you know, trying to give people an idea of what reality is. Oh, did I say that out loud? of course, this comes up, and I'm saying things like, all right, well, look at it. I mean, it's totally colored wrong, and there's only one picture of it. You know, like, I could only find one picture of it. I'm like, it's the same picture. If that phenomenon took place, there'd be hundreds of pictures from every angle,
there's,
you know.
There's a more photos link right on the website.
I'm just saying.
And look, no, there's a whole bunch of photos of the same sinkhole.
No, but I did come up with legitimate arguments, legitimate criticism, right? So I'm saying, you know, let's look at the picture. What is strange about it? The coloring looks weird. That's why, because the actual dirt in that hole has a strange color to it. It's not the color you would expect it to be. The shadows
dirt color
off. The it looks too cylindrical.
Yeah.
Right, Bob?
I agree, yep.
And the debris that's hanging over the hole from a couple of the angles, it almost looks like the guy did a bad job with the Photoshop, right?
But isn't this a perfect example of a skeptic moment here? You heard of something, you were immediately skeptical, people presented evidence to you, and you came around and believed.
Right.
Your mind
eventually
was open to evidence.
But you know what's funny?
Very good.
One thing that occurred to me was I was actually making excuses as to why it is fake.
You know what you were doing, Jay? You were anomaly hunting.
Yep,
I
was.
You were anomaly hunting. So it is a good lesson. But, you know, first of all, it is perfectly reasonable. You see something like that, your immediate reaction looks a little Photoshoppy. You know, it's also very impressive looking. You know, it would be cool if it were real. But, my first gut reaction was, that looks fake. But, you know, you go through the process. Is it plausible? Are there other pictures? I mean, you can find other pictures of it, for example. And, you know, is there any reason to suspect that it is fake or not real? But you can't be too dedicated because to one conclusion, because as you demonstrate, Jay, even if you're trying to be reasonable, it's easy to find things to that you can retrofit into the conclusion you're trying to support, right? If you're looking for reasons that it's fake, you could find them. The fact that you could find them doesn't really, it shouldn't be compelling evidence that it is in fact fake. But again, as Fraser said, the ability to come around when you look at all the evidence is what separates the skeptics from the non-skeptics.
And it is the coolest hole on Earth.
It is cool.
You know how deep that is? That's
it's big enough
stories.
For the Statue of Liberty. You could take the Statue of Liberty, lift it up, and put it down, and it would be completely hidden inside of this hole.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you have loved to see the video of when that thing fell?
Oh, yeah.
Or hear it. Oh, imagine the noise it made.
Is there any security video, maybe? Oh, man. See a building disappear. Whoops. Bye-bye.
Jay, I have a question.
Go ahead.
What were you thinking?
Sinking.
It's the black pit. The black pit is what gets me. I want to go down there and see what's in that black hole that I can't see anything. And to me, my mind creates this gargantuan cavern that prevents us from seeing any further. But it can't be that big.
It looks like a bottomless pit from that picture.
Right.
Why did it happen? And what is the pseudoscientific explanation for why it happened?
Well, I could tell you the first part. I haven't heard any pseudoscientific explanations, but they're
not yet.
Sinkholes are a very well understood phenomenon. They occur because certain kinds of rock, like limestone and rocks that can be eroded away by water, they get eroded away. They slowly get eroded away underneath, right? And they think this one happened because of Tropical Storm Agatha, I guess is what they're saying. Depending on the conditions, the water can slowly leach away and erode away the rock. And then it gets to the point where it just can't support the weight above it anymore. And one of two things will happen depending on what's above it. There's what's called a cover subsistence sinkhole, where if you have like a sandy surface, it'll just slowly sink down in and you get a depression. Maybe that's what you had in your mind when you thought of a sinkhole, more like a crater.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a cover collapse sinkhole, which is certainly what this is, where you have more of a crusty, hard covering. So that you can't see what's happening. It's not slowly sinking under. The surface looks completely normal until you get to that critical point where it can't support its weight anymore, and then it just collapses down into a cylindrical or well-shaped hole that can be hundreds of feet deep. That's what happened here. That's the cooler, more dramatic kind of sinkhole. And again, it really looks incredible.
Well, I'm going to predict that the Hollow Earth people think that's evidence.
Both of them.
Right.
Yeah, those two people.
Yeah. How is Neil Adams going to spin this to support his point of view?
And then the people who think that the Earth has oil inside of it constantly replenishing.
Right. Yeah.
Somehow.
This is the second time Guatemala's had one of these things happen in Guatemala City. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's just waiting for some sort of a sinister, the city is descending down and being consumed and taken. There's two of these, and they've been used to do archaeological work here in America where we've seen different relics were found at the base of sinkholes down in Florida. So there's a neat story, there's a neat science fiction waiting to be told, but this is real life being weirder than fiction.
Or you can use it as a big garbage dump. I mean,
that's
think
true
about
too.
It. You could put, 200 feet, 250 feet of garbage in there, pack it down, and you could still put sort of 50 feet of soil on top of it, and you're good to go.
No, that's not good, Steve.
Yeah, more than
what
that.
Else are you going to fill it in with?
And that would prevent other sinkholes from forming.
Nuclear waste.
Isn't there a cavern underneath there where the water washed away? Yeah, so they got a serious problem there.
Yeah, don't build a city on limestone, I guess, is the real lesson here. But cool. I mean, every now and then we do this, the thing that we thought was fake when we first saw it, but it turned out to be true. Those are always fun. Well, Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
It is, isn't it?
But actually, why don't we have Jay do his Who's That Noisy first?
So last week, to brighten up the show, because Rebecca was ridiculously depressed, I created spontaneously my own Who's That Noisy. So here it is.
My guess is that was a cogent Sylvia Brown, but I think I was wrong.
But unusually cogent, yeah.
I want to say that the first clue is it's a YouTube video, and I've probably watched it about 50 times.
I believe
it. Still makes 51 me now. Laugh every
is it
time.
Guys, it's like a, is it like some kind of dog or cat is having trouble breathing?
No, it's a dog. Yeah, it's a dog, yeah. And the owner has his hand on the very end of his mouth, and he's just basically like machine gunning his mouth as the dog is growling. So it's quite simple. But the dog, to me, the dog is actually making a funny face while he's doing it too. So,
right.
Steve, I'll send you the link so everyone can take a look at the video. And
yeah,
I don't know. Is it just me? Like this thing gets funnier.
It gets funnier. It gets funnier. It does.
20 million YouTube it. Hits. 10 million of them, Jay.
20 million.
Did I get it?
Yeah, you did good. You did good.
Right. You done good.
You get a virtual
and
pat on the back.
Break me though.
There were tons of people. We got responses over email. I had people hit me up on Facebook, and there were people on the message board who all guessed it. So, and because this is not really an official Who's That Noisy, everybody wins.
Everyone's a winner.
Everyone gets a prize.
Okay. Evan, give us the real Who's That Noisy.
Ah, the real one. That was fun, Jay. Thank you. All right. Here was last week's Who's That Noisy, if you recall.
Tear gas attack? Because when you cut into an onion, cells rupture, releasing enzymes which break down nearby sulfur compounds into oxides and acids.
Right.
Pamela, Fraser, any guesses?
Late night TV?
The guy who is keeping the medical secrets that they don't want you to know?
No.
No? Good guesses, no. But no.
That is
no.
A good guess, yeah.
That was celebrity chef, entertainer, actor, cinematographer, author, Alton Crawford Brown from the show Good Eats, who is he's quite a scientist. He's quite a teacher of science in that show. Tells you all about food chemistry and history of certain foods and so forth. Very entertaining. I find him fascinating. Frankly, he's one of my favorite characters on television.
Yeah, he is really cool. I've watched quite a bit of that show, and like he'll do something where, like cooking a lobster, and he just doesn't show you how to do it. He tells you why. He explains to you what's going on inside the lobster, like what, you know, chemically almost what's happening. I mean, he talked about making pancakes and explained in detail like what, you know, why you shouldn't over beat the batter and what's taking place. So if you like science and you like food preparation and cooking and eating, which I like all those things, you'd love this show.
Wow, I want to check that out.
Well, it's great to teach science in the context of a very specific practical application, like cooking, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've had questions thrown our way, and none of us are certainly, you know, food scientists or experts in any by any means. And
I'm a foodtician.
You're a foodologist.
Foodologist.
Eatologist, yeah.
Eatologist.
The first one to guess correctly, lots of people got this one, so lots of Alton Brown fans in our audience. Jamie from Canton, Michigan, sent in an email and was the first one to guess correctly. So well done, Jamie.
Good job, Jamie. What do you got for this week?
All right. For this week, here's this week's Who's That Noisy.
Wow.
That was from Forbidden Planet.
You like that?
That was legitimately creepy.
It was creepy. And it was sent in by a listener, and we'll obviously do the reveal next week. But in the meantime, you, the listener at home, need to guess Who's That Noisy and let us know. Good luck, everyone.
All right. Thanks, Evan. I think we have time for one quick email. This one comes from Paul Timmons from Ottawa, Canada, but we won't hold that against him. But Paul writes, "Hi all, the world has access to sugar substitutes for dozens of years, and most popular Baked products and beverages have sugar-free options because of great scientific work. Granted, it took a few years of research to come up with some half-decent diet colas. Today, salt is the latest problem du jour in the food industry. If the world had a salt substitute, same flavor but none of the health risks, restaurants would have an alternative. Does the chemistry of salt make this a more significant feat, or have we just not ever put our minds to the problem? Thanks. Why don't we have salt substitutes that are just as effective as the sweetener substitutes that we have?
But don't, like, raise your blood pressure.
Yeah, don't cause strokes and heart attacks and raise your blood pressure, right?
So is it the sodium or the potassium that's the evildoer in this problem?
It's primarily the sodium. So table salt is sodium chloride, and it you know, for blood pressure and things like that, it is the sodium, you know, that is the big problem. So the primary salt substitute is, in fact, potassium chloride, and there are some salt substitutes that are like half and half, sodium chloride and potassium chloride. But potassium chloride is still a salt, you know, chemically, and it is not risk-free either. It's more of a problem for your kidneys, though, than for blood pressure. So a lot of people can't tolerate the high doses of potassium chloride either.
Does it taste salty?
It tastes bitter, actually. Potassium chloride has a bitter taste to it.
Yeah.
That's not good.
Well, that's why they cut it with some sodium chloride, so then it tastes more salty.
That's
so
right, you get,
yeah, so you get like the salty taste and mouthfeel and cooking properties and everything with half the sodium, let's say. But it's not a great solution.
What about other things like potassium lactate or things that get used in other preservative processes? Do they fool our taste buds?
No, they really don't.
So I guess that's the question, right? Is there any way to mimic the taste of salt without it being salt?
There are companies that are working on this very problem, in fact, and they're having a very hard time dealing with it because they basically are all saying that the molecular basis on how we detect salt is not fully known. Mm-hmm. We know some things. For example, the folks from Department of Nutritional Sciences at Rutgers University tell us that there are two different ion channel proteins that have been implicated in salt sensing on the basis of tests in animals. But when these proteins are put out of commission, animals can still perceive salt, which means that the salt sensing picture scientists have in mind is incomplete. Mm-hmm. They think maybe G protein coupled receptors might play a role in other, which play a role in other taste pathways, may have something to do with how to perceive that salt, but they're still trying to biologically figure out how it is we perceive salt taste.
But there's other flavors that you can get at, right? Like there's like monosodium glutamate, which is a kind of a salty flavor in it.
Yeah, so monosodium glutamate is more of a flavor enhancer. So that's targeting one of the effects of salt, which is to enhance the flavor of food. And it is used as a salt substitute. It doesn't really give it a salty taste so much as it just, you know, has that flavor enhancing property as well. Although, you know, monosodium glutamate, so a lot of people can't tolerate that. It can trigger migraines and it can cause, you know, headaches or other symptoms in certain people.
Well, and it still contains sodium.
Yeah, right. So it's not a perfect solution either. I think part of the problem may be that salt is just, it's a simple chemical as opposed to glucose or sucrose. You know, the sugars, basically there's lots of different sugars that our taste buds respond to, and you can, you know, activate those receptors without having a fully digestible sugar molecule. So, you know, there was definitely a pathway to developing sugar substitutes, but how do you have something that activates, chemically acts like sodium chloride that's not putting sodium chloride into your body? You know, that's the trick.
Right
now, the best advice though for people is that the one thing that's interesting about salt is that there's a lot of conditioning in terms of what you perceive. So if you're used to salty foods, then you perceive that you need food to be very salty. It's what you're used to. And when you have less salt in food, the food does taste bland to you. But you can get yourself used to less salt in food, and then that becomes, your baseline, and that will be tolerable. Plus, also, there's lots of other spices that you can use, right? You don't have to, you know, eat salty food. You can have, you know, the food be more flavorful by using other spices. And it's just a matter of just getting yourself used to a low-salt diet rather than tricking yourself, you know, using a salt substitute that will trick you into thinking you're getting a lot of salt. I don't think that's, as far as I know, that's not right around the corner. So I wouldn't hold your breath for that.
Are there any ethnicities of food that are particularly low in sodium? Like, as someone who can't eat dairy, I know Asian food is always friendly. For someone who's a no-sodium person, is there a similar diet they can escape to?
That's a good question. I don't know about the low-sodium diets. I know actually Asian food is the high-salt diet. They have tons of salt in their diet. And even though they have less atherosclerosis because they have less, you know, bad fats in their diet, Japanese cuisine specifically is very, very high sodium, high salt, and they have a higher incidence of strokes in Asia for that reason. Whereas we get more heart attacks, you know, because of a fatty diet over here, they get more strokes because of too high sodium.
We all die.
Yeah, we all die eventually, but yeah, pick your poison. So that's the typical high sodium diet. I don't know if there's one that's particularly low sodium. I mean, everyone likes salt. I mean, it's just something that, you know, we need and we evolved to taste, obviously, and to like and to seek out. But now we live in a world where we have salt shakers and access to as much salt as we want. You know, we could definitely overload ourselves on that stimulus. Well, let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of expert skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can't be worse than last week for me. So
this is it. This is where my sort of whether or not I'm a skeptic is brought on the line. This is the ultimate test.
Are you kidding? If that's true,
I suck. You You're about to guess first.
I know. First? That's Bob's job.
Okay, here we go. A recent survey finds that 80% of poker players use performance-enhancing drugs. Item number two, new research finds that chocolate milk is as effective as prescription medications for mild to moderate depression. And item number three, new study correlates ADHD, that's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, with low maternal education, a lone parent, and being on welfare.
Huh.
Fraser, why don't you have the honor of going first?
Great. Great. all right. Well, okay. So number one, recent survey finds that 80% of poker players use performance-enhancing drugs. That sounds like coffee to me. So I'm, you know, 80% of computer programmers use performance enhancing drugs and 80% of podcasters. So I'm going to buy that. Number two finds that chocolate milk is effective as prescription medicines for mild to moderate depression. That seems kind of like a trick because I've heard that talk therapy and medication and cognitive therapy are all equivalent for treating depression, which means that maybe they're not very effective at all, which means that chocolate milk or microwaves or magnetism is as effective as treating depression. So, but number three is so politically incorrect that I can't go near it.
Come on.
But,
just do it, man. Commit.
Yeah. You know what? I'm gonna go for number three. But because from what I understand, being a single parent is very difficult. But they all sounded right. Number two. I'm going with number two because they all sound reasonable to me. So I'm gonna go with number two. Number two is the fake.
The chocolate milk one.
The chocolate milk one. Yeah.
Okay, Pamela. What do you think?
Well. So, you know, if chocolate cured depression, it seems like that trial study is so wonderful and so easy, it would have been done ages ago, and Zoloft would not be needed. So, I know that the emotional state of the parent really affects the child, and so that one seems easy to be true. Who doesn't use caffeine? And, you know, I can imagine even worse things being used if you're trying to go after such a high-stakes game. Chocolate milk, we would have figured it out long ago. Wouldn't need Zoloft, so I'm going to say that's the fake story.
Okay, Bob.
Well, the 80% of poker players using performance-enhancing drugs, yeah, I mean, that's pretty much a no-brainer. It's funny, everyone's bringing up caffeine, and there was yet another news story, which I thought for sure Steve would use today, that talked about caffeine. Actually, caffeine is not once you become used to caffeine, it's not really making you more alert. What it's doing is it's bringing you up to normal. So when you feel like your alertness level has increased, it's only because you're brought back to what's the normal level. So it's funny that everyone's saying, yeah, it's caffeine. I mean, these guys are traveling the country, entering tournament after tournament. So there's all these – I could see lots of these really, you know, potent drugs that are – or somewhat potent drugs that are letting them stay awake, focus, concentrate maybe a little bit better. So, yeah, that one's a no-brainer. These other two are going to be a pain. Chocolate milk. My first thought on that, Steve, was that it was true because I think the key was the mild to moderate depression. For some reason, I've got stuck in my head the idea that the depression medications are good for severe depression. They're really good for severe depression, but they're not so good for the mild to moderate depression. For some reason, that's in my head, and I could be totally wrong about it. But so then that would be would be true that the drugs just, you know, really aren't that good if you're just a little depressed, and who knows, maybe the riboflavin in milk helps you with mild to moderate depression. The third one also kind of makes sense to me, just from a stress point of view.
See, they all sound so reasonable.
I know, uneducated mother. You know, just the stress of, you know, having one parent taking care of you and also being on welfare. So, yeah, I mean, stress basically increases your risk of everything. So so that kind of makes sense to me too. So I gotta pick one, don't I? I'm gonna go with my gut and say that the depression is fact. So that would mean that ADHD would have to be fiction.
Okay, Jay.
All right.
Okay. The study that says 80% of poker players use performance enhancing drugs, caffeine, alcohol, probably other things to keep them awake. New research about the chocolate milk is effective as a prescription medication for mild to moderate depression. I just can't see anything that substantiates that. Like it's there's something like there's a chemical in chocolate that they say makes people feel like they're in love or gives them some type of well-being type thing. But I don't know. I just don't think they would use it as a prescription medication or it's as effective. I think that one is definitely the fake, and I definitely believe that the environment that a child is brought up in could shape their behavior, and ADHD is something I think is not, you know, some kids are probably born with it, and I think some kids are definitely affected by their environment. So there it is.
Chocolate milk,
yeah,
is the fake. Okay, Evan.
Oh crud! I knew you'd get to me eventually. Steve, I have a question about the poker players one.
Yes,
professional poker players.
That's a really good question.
Yeah, you see, because I'm a poker player. I don't consider myself a professional poker player. I mean, I enter tournaments once in a blue moon. And
I did not specify. Yeah. I did not specify professional poker players.
Ooh.
And make of that what you will.
Yeah, you know, so I don't know if that's accurate, if this poker player one is accurate or not. I'm kind of stuck on it. I know nobody else has chosen it. I'll go against my instincts. I'll say the ADHD one is fiction.
Okay, so you all agree that a recent survey finds that 80% of poker players use performance-enhancing drugs is science, right?
Sort
you
of.
All think that one's true, although Evan...
I have my doubts.
Always has his doubts. And that one is science.
Science.
That one is true. Evan, it is not just professional poker players. This is a survey that found 80% of poker players, including professional and amateur and part-time and recreational, just all poker players.
Wow.
The drugs that were commonly reported include marijuana, cocaine, amphetamines, Valium, and other prescription medications.
Whoa.
Not all of those are performance enhancing.
Yeah, that's right. How does that enhance your performance?
Right. But that's how that's how they use them. Well, some people use them to calm their nerves, some, like Valium. Other people use them to stay awake or
other
to keep
people
their
use
edge.
Them to get high.
No, but they use them specifically to enhance their performance at the poker table, but they were may have been compensating for different things.
Maybe it's also related to performance after the poker table. You know what I'm talking about?
Maybe if you're eating Cheetos for the entire time you're playing, you don't have a tell.
Yeah, to get rid of your tell. They also did mention energy drinks and caffeine and guarana, as included in that mix.
No, that's batshit.
Not guano.
That's guano.
Guarana. I thought the 80% figure was high.
It seems high.
Yeah.
They're high, Steve.
But if they're counting alcohol.
But alcohol wasn't on the list.
It would be interesting to know, what Evan said, though, right, is it what percentage of professional poker players do it?
Right.
Have they learned better that certain drugs do work and others just don't? So I'd gamble that the professionals have a much lower use or very specific.
They said it was 80% pretty much across all categories.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, then I lost that bet.
This is a study out of Nova Southeastern University. They started with they started interviewing players in the Las Vegas during the World Series of Poker, but then they expanded the survey across the globe, actually North America, Europe, and Asia.
Hey Fraser, are you upset that you just lost that bet?
I'm gonna go have a drink.
Because if you are, I have something that'll make you feel better.
Some chocolate.
Oh yeah,
right.
So that dog sound is as effective milk. As chocolate for curing
right.
My depression.
It really right. is.
Well,
it
let's
is.
Go on to number two. New research finds that chocolate milk is as effective as prescription medications for mild to moderate depression. Our guests,
come on, baby,
think
come
that's science. One is the fiction, along with Jay, Bob, and Evan think that one is science, and that one is the fiction.
Ooh.
Yeah,
yeah, boy.
Damn,
it's a fiction. I was hoping that the mild to moderate would lure you in, Bob. So Bob, you're the only one who picked up on it to your detriment.
And chocolate bastard. Has a happiness effect, right?
It does. I mean, it's not implausible that chocolate milk can make you feel better. It's kind of a comfort food. There was the whole chocolate thing, and it was just mild to moderate. So, I tried to make it as plausible as I could. Now, but what I was basing this on was a study that chocolate milk is as good, if not better, it's actually better in this study, as a post-exercise recovery drink than the actual power drinks that are made for that reason, like the high carb.
I have to try that.
Why?
Yeah, they say that it has really everything you need to replenish. It has electrolytes. It has water. It has really high-quality proteins as well as carbohydrates. It just has everything you need in just about the right ratio. So that's why they studied it. And actually, the recovery period was better with chocolate milk, and also the next time you exercise, the performance on the next round was better with chocolate milk than with other power drinks or whatever.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So what about glycogen uptake?
And glycogen, because it has carbohydrates. They mentioned that specifically.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It
repletes.
Right? And it's got fat. Protein. It's the whole package.
It is the whole package.
Well, what if you drink the skim chocolate milk?
Well, this was low fat or even fat free.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh. Low fat's a joke. Fat free though, interesting. Wow, I'm going to start doing that.
Yeah, even fat free, because it still has the protein and the carbohydrates.
What do you mean low fat's a joke?
No, low fat milk, the 2%, 1% is ridiculous.
Why? What's ridiculous?
What do you mean ridiculous?
Because the fat in milk is by volume. So 1% or 2% milk is still very fatty compared to regular milk.
Yeah, but 1%, except it tastes 1% is 25% of the fat of whole milk, so it's something.
Fat is yummy.
I hate it because it's so deceptive.
Hey, I go for the soy milk.
Oh, hey, boy. Go. The silk?
Yeah.
Soy milk is good.
It has an aftertaste to it that just lingers.
Soy is like it's an estrogen analog or something. Is there serious concerns about whether or not it's producing a hormonal effect.
Oh.
I'm going to ask Alton Brown going on with that.
Steve, is that why I have bologna tits?
Because of all the milk that you're drinking.
That's disturbing. I wish you would never say that again, please.
I love saying it.
That means that a new study correlates ADHD with low maternal education, being a lone parent, and being on welfare is science. Now, the thing that no one hit upon that I was wondering if anyone was going to perceive, the reason why this is a little surprising is that there is actual considerable evidence that ADHD is largely genetic. And the research has definitely been moving in that direction as opposed to environmental. And it really has been moving away from the blame the parenting paradigm of ADHD. However, the genetic hypothesis is not incompatible with this data, because if you have ADHD, you're at much higher risk for having a low education, getting divorced, and losing your job. So it's quite possible that not that being those things makes an ADHD child, because you're parenting, it could easily be that if you have the genes for ADHD yourself, you're likely to both have children with ADHD and also be an uneducated, divorced person on welfare.
That was tricky.
So that's a bit
but
tricky.
But isn't part of the problem the fact that ADHD, kind of like with autism, it's all about the diagnosis, and that in the right parenting circumstance, it can mask or compensate for the effects of the ADHD?
That is certainly a very reasonable thought, and I think that's how most people feel, that we perceive the relationship between our parenting style and our children's behavior. We largely delude ourselves into thinking that we have a lot of control over our child's personality and behavior, when the research shows that you don't, that the only thing you really have control over is your relationship with your children, but not really anything about their personality. And that, parenting style isn't really a huge determining factor in ADHD. It really does seem to be that something they're just born with. So could you deal with ADHD with just parenting? Well, there is good evidence to suggest that there are techniques, some essential behavioral techniques that do mitigate ADHD, and that can be extremely useful, like having a consistent boundaries, being absolutely consistent in the consequences of actions, using positive reinforcement, etc. So certainly if you have a parenting style that uses all of those suggestions, the ADHD is likely to be better controlled than if you have a parent who's checked out and is not really paying attention. But will that be enough to actually make them lose the diagnosis? Probably not. They'll probably still have the diagnosis. The other thing is with autism and probably ADHD, if anything, there's a positive correlation with getting the diagnosis and being in a more affluent, higher socioeconomic group, higher educational group, because those types of people seek out resources and diagnoses more, right? Mm. All right. Well, good job, everyone. Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
I did. I picked a astronomically themed quote because of our guest rogues. Yeah. I'm going to pronounce this man's name wrong.
All right.
I cannot figure out how to pronounce it. Is it
Ptolemy? Astronomy cast.
Ptolemy.
We
always pronounce things wrong.
As
so don't worry about
house.
Is it Ptolemy or Ptolemy?
Ptolemy.
Ptolemy.
Don't forget the P.
It's Ptolemy.
Jay, do you like pterodactyls?
didn't Ptolemy say the Earth is the center of the universe? Is that the quote you were saying?
No. All right, here's the quote. Mortal as I am, I know that I am born for a day. But when I follow at my pleasure the serried multitude of the stars in their circular course, my feet no longer touch the earth. Ptolemy! And who was he?
He was an ancient Greek astronomer.
I'm now going to plug Astronomy Cast.
Oh,
we're
do it.
In the process of a multi-part series on the history of astronomy. Part 2 covers the Greeks, including Ptolemy, and how wrong he was.
Yeah,
that's right.
But also how right he was in how careful he was, but also quite wrong in the Ptolemaic model with the epicycles. Center of the universe. And then other than that, I highly recommend you check out Universe Today, which is the which is my day job.
And it is every single news story is there. I check it before I check ArchiveX.
Well, thanks for joining me this week, everyone.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks,
Steve.
A lot of fun.
Thanks again, Pamela and Fraser.
Anytime.
Pleasure.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.